A lot of people define product marketing as the academic definition of like research, position message, blah, blah, blah. I really think a product marketing superpower, and this is, I hire for this and train for this, is people that are adaptable and are marketing generalists. If they needed to be, they could be the first marketer in a company, and they can deal with whatever pivot happens. And so I think the best product marketers are the most adaptable people in a company. And it's more about adapting to, hey, is product management need help with research this quarter? Okay, let's help them out. Oh, they don't next quarter because the new VP of research wants to do it all? Cool, awesome. Does sales have a sales enablement team right now? Oh, they do? Okay, we don't need help with that? Cool, next quarter. Oh, the new CRO doesn't believe in sales enablement? We need help? Sure. Like that kind of flexibility, I think can be a superpower in product marketing and will be forever.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Product Marketing Life, the show where we sit down with everyday product marketers to talk life, career, and most importantly, product marketing. If we haven't met before, my name is Colin Majak. I'm the lead PMM at Classy from GoFundMe. And in this episode, I got a chance to sit down with Jeff Hardison. If you don't know Jeff, Jeff is the VP of Product Marketing at Calendly. And in this episode, we did a deep dive on Jeff's take on the past, the present, and the future of product marketing. We also talked about Jeff's take on the product marketing superpower, which I'll let you listen in on to hear. And we did a dive on all things PLG. I really loved this conversation with Jeff. I felt like it was open and vulnerable and unexpected, and I think you will too. Enjoy the episode. Jeff, it's really good to meet you. How are you?
Doing great, Colin. Thanks for having me.
I want to address out the gate that I look like I got in a fight, but I did not get in a fight. I got in a fight with my dermatologist who decided things needed to get removed from my face.
Did your dermatologist also, are they like a Brazilian jiu-jitsu person too?
That's exactly right. Yeah, it had me in a chokehold as they removed these things from my face. So I look, for those who are listening, I look very battered and bruised, but YouTube will show that crystal clear. Now, if I remember, Jeff, are you in Portland?
I am in Portland, Oregon.
Okay, so you are my now fourth guest who is based in Portland, Oregon.
Wow.
Using an elastic definition of Portland. We got people up in Vancouver, I think as far south as like West Lynn, but like yeah. Portland metro. Are you in Portland proper?
I'm in Portland proper, yeah.
All right, whereabouts?
The northeast section of the city. So I'm probably like a 10-minute drive into downtown.
Okay. I lived in Northwest off 23rd.
Okay.
For like 5 years, and then on the east side off 28th and Burnside for another couple of years.
Okay.
So I lived in Portland 7 years.
Yeah.
And I have a strong opinion that it is the unsung hero of food cities in the US.
We like to think so. Yeah, we think we're a food town.
Well, I mean, I think Portland is. Like, I think you'd be hard pressed to find another place where you can find as much food as close together as cheap as it is. Now it's gotten more expensive. But I love and miss the food in that city. My running joke was like people were so depressed from the weather that their only coping was we brew beer and we make food just to like feed the dopamine deficit.
Yeah.
So I asked those other three guests this, and I want to ask you, do you have a favorite restaurant in Portland?
Oh man, so many.
You can give a short list if you have to, but
well, you know, I could list like ones that'll, you know, give me cred or whatever, but I'll be frank with you and tell you, we probably eat almost weekly at Por Que No Mexican restaurant.
Okay. You're in good company. That was Andy McCotter Bicknell's. If you know Andy, he does a healthy competition, yeah. The competitive community. Yeah. So that was his answer as well, was Por Que No.
Yeah. It's just so good. But in terms of things that give me more probably credibility in the food scene, my nephew is like a chef, so I have to kind of like say something cooler. I would say Con. I mean, we just recently ate at Con, which is Haitian food, and they won the James Beard Award. I think like Chef won it 1 year, and then the restaurant, I think, won it another year. So kind of back-to-back award show place. That's a pretty cool place, great food, great ambiance. Everything.
So that's your foodie flex.
That's my foodie flex.
Con.
Exactly. But really, I'm eating a Por Que No every week.
Oh, Por Que No is so good. The Brian's Bowl was my go-to.
Mine is the salad, so I can feel like I'm healthy. And then I'll usually get like a fish taco, biscotto, you know, and then like maybe some special vegetarian taco.
Oh, it's so good. So you're probably at the one off Mississippi, right?
Yes.
Okay.
But I go to both, you know.
Hard recommendation from Jeff for anyone visiting Portland. Por que no? I always love getting to talk to folks like you, not just folks who live in Portland, but folks like you who work for products that are really well known or that everyone knows. So for people who don't know, you are VP of product marketing at Calendly. And at this stage, nearly everyone has a Calendly link, or maybe like a competitor's link. If you're in sales, right, you might have like Chili Piper. And at this point, Calendly has this level of brand and product awareness that is made. And I'm just curious, has that made product marketing easier for you or more difficult, somewhere in the middle?
I mean, I could talk about this for a while, but I'd say, like, in short, I think the difficulty is equal in a small company where I'm like the first marketer and I'm applying product marketing principles of like less than 50 employees, because I'm kind of trying to go zero to one and doing all the work myself and maybe one other marketing employee, and having to convince, you know, founders who maybe have never worked with a marketer before that what I'm doing, there's some method to the madness. I think that can be just as challenging as being in a 500 person company where you have to go align with like multiple product managers and multiple marketing people and multiple executives. It's just a different kind of hard, right? And so with the latter, it's more about kind of like trying to just figure out how to move forward and be collaborative with a bunch of people with different opinions. And the other is more about just like pushing the rock up the hill in terms of like getting someone to notice your startup, right? Which is can be sometimes even harder.
Okay. I'm so glad you've said that, because that completely tracks with my experience. Like I've done the founding PMM thing at two startups, and that has like a certain level of difficulty to it, in that you have a lot you need to execute on. But I feel like now I'm at a larger company. I work for GoFundMe, and the hard is totally different, in that it's exactly what you described, like having to convince internally that there is a method around product marketing and an approach that is worth them actually adopting or listening to. Yeah, that problem just like doesn't go away. It just changes form.
Well, and even just building on that, like, well, what makes marketing hard? I mean, marketing is not that hard of a profession. It's like some writing some stuff, some drawing some stuff, convince somebody to buy something, right? What makes it difficult is, A, every marketer is trying to differentiate themselves from each other, because there's this like Freudian narcissism of minor differences, where we have to come up with like new terms and new approaches that are just like a tiny bit, a minor difference from what someone else's marketing is. Product marketing for PLG versus sales led, right? So there's that thing going on, right, that you have to combat. And then two, because it's creative and it's so subjective in terms of what is good marketing, which we could also talk about forever, and difficult to measure, so many people want to weigh in, right? And so there's like a lot of times you'll see founders kind of like let their engineering team go when they say, hey, it's going to take us twice as long to build this. They're like, well, I don't know. I'm not, you know, in there, and I'm not as good of a coder as you are, or whatever, unless they're like a programmer founder. But with marketing, everybody's got his opinion. So it's less about the work is hard. It's more of the collaboration is hard, and it can be difficult at tiny company to a larger company.
Do you feel like, is that unavoidable?
I think it's unavoidable. I think it is just the nature of the job. Unless you decide to found your own company, you know, you found your own startup and you outsource the engineering to someplace and you do it all yourself, you know, I think could make it easier, but you can do more amazing things the more people that you bring along with you, right? And that was something it took me a long time to learn, is that I used to love like being this generalist that could just do it all myself and like try to like save the day all by myself, right? And then I learned that you can do so much more if you have a diversity of opinions and people that are helping you do the thing across multiple touch points and at the same time. But it takes a different skill to learn to bring them along versus just trying to do it all yourself.
Yeah. That is both a helpful thing for me to hear and not what I wanted to hear. I'll tell you why it wasn't why I wanted to hear. Because I wanted to hear your silver bullet for how you get all these folks on board and it's not this necessary evil of getting kind of pecked to death by everyone's opinions on marketing. But it's what I need to hear, because I think, at least I'll speak to my personality. I don't know if this is all product marketers, but I can get stuck in this rut of feeling like I know the way product marketing should be done. I have a whole opinion on it. I write about it. I think about it all the time. And if you guys would just get on board, this would be so much easier. And I recognize the arrogance of that. So this safe space between you, me, and the listeners. But I think what you're saying is actually really valuable, is that the best stuff you do, yeah, it might have that direction you brought to the table. That's amazing. But if it can be shaped and molded and crafted by all these other disciplines and all these other perspectives, and it still holds up on the other side, then you know you've like cracked into something good.
Yeah, I think so. And there, and you know, don't get me wrong, there are ways to like help alignment. I did a talk for PMM Alliance around like how to align with various stakeholders a few years ago. And there's all kinds of, you know, tactics I use to try to move the situation forward. But, you know, you just, it never stops. You're always realigning, and you're not just realigning with existing executives and stakeholders. There's new particularly in fast moving, ever changing startups. There's new executives join all the time. You know, CRO leaves, a new CRO joins, a product officer leaves, a new one joins, they hire different product managers. Like, you're constantly realigning with people. And then the business changes quarter to quarter. And then, you know, maybe the CEO's opinion on what kind of marketing they want to use changes. And so if you're not listening to people and talking with them and getting their feedback on what you're doing and like building in public, you're going to have trouble getting your work done as a product marketer.
Yeah. I want to come back to some things on Calendly in a couple minutes, mm-hmm. but you've hinted at this, your experience at large companies, smaller companies. You've been in marketing, based on my LinkedIn sleuthing, for like 20 years,
yeah.
which is awesome. And 20 years ago, the discipline product marketing, you pointed out, did exist, but it didn't have nearly the prominence that we've seen in the last couple of years. And even if you look at the last year, there's been all this debate and back and forth on what is product marketing, what isn't product marketing. So I would love your perspective as someone who's kind of seen this beast evolve. How do you feel like product marketing has evolved since your time as a product marketer?
So I think 50 years ago, product marketing was basically like brand marketing and consumer companies like Procter & Gamble and General Mills, where the CEO was a marketer, right? And a lot of consumer companies, the CEO has a marketing or sales background. And product marketing was almost this academic definition of where, okay, we're going to bring this product to market. We're going to do some research, you know, the competition, the market, talk to customers, do some focus groups. We're going to do some positioning messaging. We're going to like align with sales and customer success if it makes sense. Sometimes it doesn't in consumer worlds. We're going to launch this thing, and then we're going to go do ongoing adoption marketing and complete the circle. And it was very academically done for decades. And then what happened was the tech industry got a hold of product marketing. You know, I think it was the founders of Hewlett-Packard saw that what was going on in Procter & Gamble and so forth and General Mills. And they said, we're going to adopt this notion of a product marketer, brand marketer, and kind of have him be this general manager for the product. The challenge, what happened was that in tech particularly, it's one thing to understand how, you know, toothpaste works. It's very different to understand how like a server works or storage in IT. And so they create this role of like the product manager, and the product manager was kind of more the technical, like it was the engineer with people skills. And this relegated the product marketer to be less of like the leader of the product as they had been in consumer. And they became more of the sales engineer for sales in these sales-led environments. And then what happened 10 years ago was that PLG emerged, right? Self-serve emerged, where these founders said, wait, we don't need to hire a bunch of salespeople. We're going to have credit card sales. It's going to be like a consumer application. And what they did was, because many of them came from consumer backgrounds or at least, you know, admired consumer companies, they went and grabbed the old model of product marketing and brought it to the future. And so it looks more like the product marketing you would study, you know, if you were going into a consumer company, you know, 50 years ago, where it's very research heavy, very data driven, lots of talking to customers, lots of looking at competitors, positioning messaging, sure, maybe less sales enablement, CS enablement, right? Because they're kind of second class citizens sometimes in PLG. still a lot of launches, but even more ongoing adoption marketing, because you would look at the data and be like, we just launched this thing, but only 20% of our customers are using it. Let's go drive some adoption. So I think, you know, simply put, PLG, product-led growth, companies have really increased the amount of product marketing.
Yeah. Do you think that explains, that shift explains some of, you'll see companies like Airbnb who have since sunsetted the role of product manager and kind of try to move all of that into product marketing. Does that make sense of that shift?
Yeah. And I don't know if I would do that if I were a CEO. I think there's
not
value.
Recommending it.
Yeah. I think there's value in having both what I defined as product managers earlier. It's the technically minded person who can speak the language of engineering and design and has, but really likes the people skill side of that versus just the coding section, right? Some of the best product managers I know had, you know, some development background, software development background in their background. That's still very valuable to have that person, you know, in the mix. However, product marketers need to have even more people skills than a lot of product managers, because they need to be able to present to analysts. They need to be able to present to journalists. They need to be able to speak in front of the whole company. They need to be able to convince not just product, not just engineers and designers, but also sales and CS and marketers who are all very right-brained, right? And so you got to be even more savvy when it comes to people skills.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense to me, that seeing like this kind of pendulum swing where at one point, yeah, product marketing was sitting at something more akin to a product manager, very heavy on the strategy, but obviously with this external facing arm. The dawn of the product manager sort of changing the role, and then PLG moving it back into the seat that's more strategic, but still requires all of that internal finessing that you described. Now that PLG is kind of, it's in the mix. It's like, it's here to stay. Where do you think product marketing is headed? Do you have a prediction on kind of how the role will evolve in the next couple of years?
I think it will continue to, well, if you're in a PLG company or a developer tools company where you can self-serve and, you know, download an SDK or whatever, I think that you'll continue to see product marketing look more like consumer product marketing, where it's very inbound front end, you know, inbound product marketing related, where you're doing a lot of research, talking to customers together with the product managers, doing private beta tests with them, looking at competitors, looking at the market. I think you're going to see that just increase the research side and the data analysis side. And so you'll probably see product marketers learning some SQL or at least demanding some easy to use, you know, data tool, like say, you know, Amplitude or Heap. So a lot more data analysis, both quantitative and qualitative, because of the influence of the consumer side of the business. That said, I think that a lot of people define product marketing as the academic definition of like research, position message, blah, blah, blah. I really think a product marketing superpower, and this is, I hire for this and train for this, is people that are adaptable and are marketing generalists. If they needed to be, they could be the first marketer in a company, and they can deal with whatever pivot happens. And so I think the best product marketers are the most adaptable people in a company. And it's more about adapting to, hey, is product management need help with research this quarter? Okay, let's help them out. Oh, they don't next quarter because the new VP of research wants to do it all? Cool, awesome. Does sales have a sales enablement team right now? Oh, they do? Okay, we don't need help with that? Cool, next quarter. Oh, the new CRO doesn't believe in sales enablement? We need help? Sure. Like that kind of flexibility, I think, can be a superpower in product marketing and will be forever.
Yeah, that's really interesting to me. And I think I'll chew on it, but I could see definitely the rise in the need for inbound if you're moving more and more where there isn't the sales enablement arm. Like that's going to become less and less used, that all those inbound skills will become increasingly important. And as product marketing has evolved, so have other roles like demand generation. Like that, with that role kind of has been really hit its stride in the last couple of years. So I like that take. I want to sit on it a little bit more, but I like it.
Some people don't like that take. You know, some people are like, they don't like
what's
it.
What's not to like about it?
There are, I think there's some people, there's a divide in product marketing, people who think that product marketing should be one way. And if your company doesn't allow you to do it, like 20% research, 20% position messaging, 20% sales note, 20% launches, 20%, you know, if they don't think it's like completely even, they think that the company's doing it wrong, right? And there's another faction of people like me who believe that you should just be flexible because humans are humans. And product marketing wasn't something like, it's not like engineering where it's like, it's clearly always the same software development in a lot of companies. You know, they code, that's what they do. Whereas every company is different because we need a group in the company that's flexible. Not everybody can be stubborn and put up boundaries all the time and say like, sorry, we don't do that. You got to have at least one team in marketing that's always flexible. And it tends to usually be product marketing. And that's why they get pulled into different directions.
Yeah. That maps really well into my experience. I feel like if you actually did a deep dive into, I've held the title product marketer 4 times, but if you did a deep dive into what I did in each of those 4 roles, total variance. Like it changed massively because the environment demanded something different. Or you have someone who's great at one thing, but you have a deficit here. Like right now I feel like there are days I play PM role more than I ever have. And that's the nature of the beast.
Yeah. Same here. You know, sometimes you play product manager role because whatever, you know, and it's really about less about how am I doing product marketing by the book, like I learned in school. And it's more about how am I helping this company grow? And I have a bunch of different skills and there's a bunch of different things they need that product marketers can do. Why not help out? Like that's what it's about.
Yeah. I almost wonder though, if there's this fear to be flexible. Lisa, I can imagine this because say you're a designer or even your example of a developer, there's a very tangible, consistent deliverable. Looks the same all the time. Versus like, did you code? What was the quality of that code? Or did you have this design output? What was the quality of that design output? Whereas if you choose to operate in this flexible way, it gets to like either layoff time or assessment of your performance. And I wonder if there's this fear that you've made yourself vulnerable of like, well, I didn't tie to one clear thing. Like I flexed here and then I put on my product manager hat there. And then I was in this whole big conversation and like a central piece about whether we go after this market, but like, I just helped drive the decision. I guess the question I'm asking is, I wonder if that level of flexibility opens you up to being vulnerable by not having this clear, consistent, repeatable deliverable.
It's a good point. I think you have to ask yourself, like, what's my ultimate goal as a human at this company? Is my ultimate goal to stick around and never get laid off or misunderstood? Or is my ultimate goal to make change and help the company grow? And know in my heart, I helped. And if they didn't recognize it and they didn't know, that's on them. But I know I tried my best and I know I made a difference. And so you are, regardless if you're being put, I know with just as many product marketers that have put up boundaries and said like, we don't do research or we don't do, you know, we don't help the sales team or whatever.
Yeah.
We don't help content. You know, those people get just as laid off and fired as the ones who you're always wondering what they do. The bottom line is marketers, it is a vulnerable position. It doesn't matter if you work in demand gen or content marketing or product marketing. It's probably one of the most vulnerable positions because it's so subjective as to whether you did a good job or not. Right. It's more akin to being an interior designer for a rich person is really what a marketer is. And so, you know, there's all these stories. You talk to contractors and designers are like, we worked with this, you know, this mansion where we like redid the kitchen completely and they didn't like it. And a year later, they had us do it back the old way. Like that is marketing in a tech company. Right.
So accurate.
So you're always going to be vulnerable. So all you really can do is just try to do the best job you can and know in your heart that you did a good job.
Yeah. I like that. And I think even to your point earlier, you talked so much about influence. And I asked the question because I think it's a legitimate one. But I also know from experience, sometimes those people who just insert themselves wherever there's a gap, those are the people that you look out and be like, if I were founding a company tomorrow, I'm bringing that person with me. And so you just have to trust that if you approach your work that way as a PMM, because the role is so broad, like it, you talked about like this neat 20% thing, just there's like five or six roles, depending on how you think about it, rolled up into PMM. Yeah. And I just like that idea of trusting that, like, if I insert myself wherever there's a genuine need, one, I will help the company, and two, that will get noticed, whether by 100%. This company or elsewhere.
100%. Like, the people who reach out to me from past companies that work in sales or CS, and they're like, hey, I referred you for a role, or like, I just want to tell you, I miss working with you. It's the number one reason, I think, is because I was flexible and I tried to help them out. It wasn't because I was very principled about, I must do 20% research. Anytime I try to be principled, I create enemies, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you come out saying this is the way it should be.
Yes.
It makes for, it's clear, but it's, yeah, it's, it can be polarizing.
But why are we even saying it should be? Like, where are the, like, the stone tablets with, like, what product marketing is? We literally made this job up, you know?
Well, I keep picturing when you talk about the 20% rule, not to pick on Richard King, but sorry, Richard. Like, I picture like him twitching somewhere. If you for some reason go against that, you know, the kind of famous PMA diagram of product marketing.
Yeah.
Like, you've skewed the balance in the force, and somewhere out there, like, Richard is twitching.
I think he would agree with this point, and that I could be wrong, but I think he would. It's not that you don't do the research, position messaging, sales enablement, launches, ongoing adoption marketing. You always do those things. It's the percentage of your time that you spend on them that changes. 100%. There's never a quarter that goes by that my team's not doing some research, but there's some quarters that go by where it's only like 10% of their time.
Yeah. And Richard, if you listen to this, appreciate you. You're the figurehead of clear thinking on product marketing. We've totally derailed from here, but I feel like it'd be a massive miss if I didn't talk to you about PLG a little bit more, because I know, one, Calendly is a poster child of PLG in my mind. And it's very easy for people to get a free account, get up and running, upgrade that account if they need to, and so on. And I know that you write about PLG. Like, this is one of your hobby horses and one of your babies, so to speak.
Yeah.
With all that said, I also know Calendly has a significant part of their business that's sales-led, at least as I understand it. So I would be curious, when you're thinking about launching new products or features, you have some sort of go-to-market initiative, how are you thinking about those two areas of go-to-market differently? Or like, how are you balancing that PLG versus sales-led motion?
I try to look at the math of the situation and say, how much of this company's revenue comes from self-serve credit card sales, somebody inputting their credit card number and buying, and how much of it is from our sales team or CS team closing the deal with humans. And so, like, at Envision, it was PLG, the design tool, but it was much more sales-led in terms of the revenue. At Calendly, it's more credit card. And so at Envision, I was spent hours upon hours with salespeople and customer success leaders trying to figure out, how do we help you all? Like, how do we help you? Because you're making the most amount of the money for the company. How do we help you go up market? But then I would also spend time, you know, working with like the pricing team to figure out, like, how do we make this a little bit, you know, fairer in terms of like, why does somebody need to buy from the sales team? Like, what's the differentiation? Why can't we move some of that value over into the credit card plans, right? So like, that was a lot of the role there. And then at Calendly, we look at the numbers and it's just overwhelmingly credit card sales. And so it makes total sense right now that we're thinking more like growth marketers, lifecycle marketers, where we are saying like, okay, someone signs up for free. What's their experience? How can we help make that the best experience? And then how do we get them to find out about gated features, you know, that are on certain paid credit card plans? And then how do we make sure that we don't just send everybody over to sales, but we provide enough like helpful documents and videos and the help center and so forth so they can self-serve? Like, that's a lot of what we spend our time doing right now, because the revenue calls for it.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Just in some ways, having this clear trail, you're following the revenue. All right. Yeah. Like, in terms of the attention that we give, and which even seems to be, I mean, forgive me if I'm putting words in your mouth, that seems to be one of your general methodologies about thinking about PMM in general. Just like product marketers should just be thinking about how does this company make money and then how do I attach myself and build strategies around around that revenue. Is that a fair read?
That's a fair read. How does this company make money? Where does the money come from? Who needs help in helping grow the company? Is it the growth product managers? We need to help them. Is it the sales team? Is it, you know, whatever. I would say the other one is, and this is something I've learned at Calendly. Do you want to lean into where you're already successful? Like certain ICPs, like say we sell to accountants, right? And we do really well there organically. Do we want to go corner that market and go lean into it? And so like we are the de facto standard for scheduling in the accountant world. Yeah. Or do we want to go push the rock up the hill, Sisyphean style, and go after a target audience, not an ICP, a target audience that we want to do well in. I'm making this up. Let's say it's like life coaches or something. We want to do well there. And so let's go push the rock up the hill. There's a lot of competitors there. We don't have a lot of organic growth, but we want to do well for some strategic reason. That choice is a one that I think about a lot.
Yeah. I mean, do you feel like you skew one way or the other? Because, I mean, I'll give a little context. I was put in a situation where when I arrived at my current company, I had a lot of knowledge about an industry that, to your point, your distinction, this was not an ICP. This was a target audience, someone that they could go after. And so I did a big proposal of like, here's what it would actually take. Do you actually want to go after them? Because here's what it would involve. And ultimately, like I talked them off the ledge of like, y'all aren't building for this. We're not ready for this. And that's probably my leaning of like, go where you can conquer the mountain rather than the push up the hill where maybe you haven't built for it. Do you lean one way or the other? Or do you feel like it really is a matter of circumstance?
So the tiny startup person, when I'm in a smaller startup, it's like 20 people and I'm seeing them push a rock up the hill and they're not getting anywhere. Like Atlytics, this customer data platform I worked for, we were going after e-commerce companies. Well, these e-commerce companies were going out of business, these clothing companies, whatever, like all the time. So we would sell to them and we felt so cool selling to them because they were also technology people just like us. And like we got along really well, right? And it was pressed to have those brands, but they would go out of business. And it was pushing a rock up the hill in many ways. And then we went and looked at the data and we found it was like traditional publishers, like American Banker Magazine, were paying for Lytics and we weren't even marketing to them and we weren't building features for them. We weren't joining their like watering holes. And we went and just said like, all right, let's just try to be sensible about this and go after just publishers for like a whole year. And we were able to like 10X the company in terms of revenue by doing that. And it was like conquer one beachhead at a time.
Yeah.
That's when I'm in a smaller company, that makes a lot of sense. I have seen in PLG, because it's self-serve, you can just have organic growth in different places. It's kind of cool. Like you can just have people sign up for free and you don't even know they're signing up. These like it could be, again, accountants that are signing up for free and they're upgrading their credit card. You wouldn't even know it if you didn't look at the data.
Yeah.
And there's something beautiful to letting that organic work happen and then go like, all right, if I have to use humans, I'm going to go use it where it's not organically happening. Like I see the value of that too. I'm in the middle.
Yeah. Well, thinking about it through the extent to which you are a product-led company and that helping be a good indicator of how to act and whether to take kind of that new hill. That's a really interesting filter that I wouldn't have thought about. Cause I mean, in our shoes, the product that I was trying to take to market, very much not product led, but right. If there's an easy self-serve function, you could do like a pretty low cost attempt to try to reach that audience and just see like, do they buy, do they onboard into whatever, like your trial or your freemium? And if they don't, okay, no harm, no foul. Like we don't keep going after them. Or you can have this kind of pulse where you're like, hey, we're starting to see a lot of people who fit this audience come in. That's unexpected. Yeah. And it could be like the signal of whether to invest more. Like that's where like PLG, aside from the revenue, actually becomes a really helpful tool just to test various markets.
You know what's something? So getting in touch with like looking behind the numbers and looking at customers is something that's big on our team. And so one of the things we started doing is we will go get an export, CSV of everybody that signed up and paid with their credit card in the last 80 to 90 days. And then we as a team will get together and do an hour of power and go look these people up on LinkedIn. We won't trust like their data enrichment tools because sometimes it's wrong. Or we'll look these people up on LinkedIn, you know, and try to see like what's the nature of these people that have upgraded their credit card. And are we seeing patterns? Like, is it all of a sudden there's like software designers, you know, like that are using it? Is it all of a sudden like life coaches? Is it all of a sudden like, you know, consultants? Is there a bunch of people doing it as a side hustle because of the economy? Like, just looking behind the numbers and trying to get to know some of these people that are paying you money is a really great exercise.
As soon as you said I pulled a CSV, I knew I was going to like it because I knew it was going to be scrappy and tell you something that you can't get any other way.
Right.
I don't know. Like it's so easy to be like, oh, we'll just do like, we'll trust our internal surveys, or we'll trust, heaven forbid, you trust what's logged in the CRM. So I really like that. I like that tactic.
Yeah, it's fun. And it's just fun to get to know who these people are, like care about them as humans, you know?
Yeah. Now, on that continued note of PLG, you've not been under a rock. So you know that PLG has been like one of the hot product marketing issues, in particular the last couple of years. And it seems like every company, regardless of whether your product actually lends itself to PLG, wants in on it. And I've talked to folks on this podcast about how PLG is a spectrum, not an on or off switch. Shout out to Madison Leonard on that. And there's like this series of semi-progressive tools and tactics that you can use to make your go-to-market increasingly more product-led. Now, I would love your perspective, like just putting yourself in the shoes of a product marketer who is at a company with a strong sales-led motion. Would you have any advice for them as they start exploring integrating more of those elements of PLG?
Yeah. I did, I think it was like 5 years ago, I did one of the first with Wes Bush product-led growth podcast episodes. And this was back when everybody was like, you got to go PLG, don't do sales-led. Like, it was all like zealotry. And I was like, hey, I work in a PLG company. And like, you need to like think about whether it makes sense for your company. And I had this graphic, I wish I still had it, where it said like, if the company is selling something very technical, like let's say like a customer data platform, like I mentioned earlier, like Lytics or Segment or whatever. If it's something very technical, you need to ask yourself, is the product easy enough to use that like a layperson could sign for free for it and not blow up your customer support channel with all kinds of questions? And if they are asking a bunch of questions, are you dutiful enough that you're going to go create a bunch of help center articles and videos and so forth that take time so that they can self-serve on learning? Because you might find that you're hiring just as many support people as you would have salespeople if you would have said sales-led. And so we actually came up to that situation with Lytics where we were like, look, this product it requires all kinds of different stakeholders in companies. It's, you know, you got to add like a JavaScript tag to your product or your website. Like, there's some technical stuff you need to do, and we just can't have a bunch of lay people marketers sign up for free and then getting frustrated. And so we kept it very sales-led at the time. They've moved to, you know, like to your point, they've incrementally moved into self-serve, but we weren't ready to make the commitment on all the help docs and videos and support people we were going to have to make it work. So that's the question I would ask, is like, just think logically. Does this thing need humans to implement? And if so, maybe you're not ready yet, but if you're ready to do the work of creating things that are always on, like help center articles, videos, you know, onboardings, tours, and all that, then maybe give it a try.
Yeah. I like that filter of just how much explanation will actually be required. And are you going to create all the tools, and or is it easier just to have a human who will do all that explanation and kind of be that touch point?
Yeah.
To close, one thread I'm noticing, and I did not prep you for this, was throughout our kind of entire conversation, you have pushed back on this idea of there being one right way to be a PMM. Like even a minute ago, you made a nod to like a stage of zealotry. And early on, you've talked a lot about flexibility. Where do you feel like that perspective was born for you? Like, where did that kind of come from?
I think I've always had problems when people try to think in very black and white ways. And they're just like, there is one truth and there's one, you know, this is good, this is bad. I just have a problem with that personality type, honestly, my entire life. And so I think that I just don't believe there is one black and white truth and one, you know, falsehood. And there's a lot of grayness in the world. And so why not like lean into the grayness and try to be a good listener and hear different people's perspectives, whether it's politics or religion or, you know, the economy or even running a tech company, right? And how to do product marketing. And so that's just kind of, it's just something I believe. And I think it's served me well in doing product marketing because people want to work with flexible people.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, thank you. This was a lot of fun. I appreciate you letting me throw a couple questions your way I did not prep you for. If folks want to keep up with you while you're up to it, Calendly, where can they do that?
Well, please come be my friend on LinkedIn. Just look up Jeff Hardison and you should find me on LinkedIn. I've also got a PLG marketing newsletter that's on Substack. I'm not as prolific as I should be, but I have fun when I do it. So please subscribe to that and, on podcast from time to time. And I hope you enjoyed this one.
Sweet. I'll try to get that link from you and share it when I post about it. But again, thanks, man. Thanks for chatting.
Thanks, Colin. This has been really fun. These have been great questions.
Glad you liked it. We'll chat soon.
For everyone still tuned in, thanks so much for listening. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please help us spread the word to other product marketers. Thanks again and have a great morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever you are.